Well, I am a Trekkie. That means that I like Star Trek. When we interviewed Reggie for youth pastor position, we had to ask him, one of the first questions that we asked him was, Star Trek or Star Wars? It was a trick question because I like both of them equally. But I'm a Trekkie and I watched Star Trek back in the day when the stars and everything went behind at a rapid rate behind a very fixed ship right there. It was the best that we had and it was awesome. But I particularly like this reboot in 2009 with Chris Pine. I don't know if you've seen that, but the new Star Trek is the old Star Trek with the new cast. They did a brilliant job with it. They had Chris Pine as Captain Kirk, and it is wonderful. I think even way better than the first one, and I love the first one. But that particular episode of the reboot in 2009, it starts with his dad dying in a mysterious sort of an invasion from a ship that no one has ever seen before. His dad dies in this sort of catastrophic, this catastrophic, devastating attack. And then the movie basically full stops, and then you see this old Corvette Stingray coming in the plains of Kansas, just out of control, careening down the road, and you realize that there's a 12-year-old behind the steering wheel. And it's this wild child, young guy, and he's riding around, and blazes past a friend, and then he all of a sudden realizes that there's a hovering kind of motor hover thing, you know, that a policeman is now caught him in the act. Again, he's in a Corvette. He makes a hard right onto a road, heading right toward a cliff. He jumps out of the car at the last minute. The car goes over the cliff. He's hanging by the cliff, gets back up on top of the land. And then the officer says, "Who are you, son?" And he said, "James Tiberius Kirk." And that's the beginning of the story. But what we're seeing in this wild child is that the loss of his dad left a mark. It left a mark on him. And his life was now the result of this unfinished business. And a lot of the movie is about him kind of having to learn the hard way, pushing through this unfinished business of his past. I have the same kind of history in my life. I had unfinished business in the past. Peter, in the story that we're going to look at today, has unfinished business from his recent past. And Jesus is going to take it by the hand and restore him and reinstate him back into his right standing with Jesus and back into the call and his purpose. And so what we're going to see in this particular passage is that this risen Jesus brings restoration wherever he goes. He sets things right. He sets things right with Peter in this case, and he sets things right with you and with me. And that's what we're going to discover as we jump in. Now, the events of 2.5, 3 weeks before basically go like this. These are what we call the Passion of the Christ. These are horrific events. That Jesus is betrayed by Judas, one of his inner circle. He's arrested. He's dragged from ruler to ruler, from official to official. Peter denies him 3 times. There's a mock trial. He's rejected. He's beaten to the edge of death. He's made to carry his own cross, of which he dies on it. It's brutal. It's terrible. It's horrific in the worst way that something can be horrific. And those who watched were devastating. Everything in their world died with him. But then, on day 3, he rose. Like he said he would. He rose on the 3rd day. This is the message of the New Testament, is that this Jesus who died on the cross was raised on the 3rd day, and he's alive today. And he's still interacting with human beings like you and me. And he's still redeeming people. He's still bringing the kingdom to all of us. Now, this eyewitness, John, who writes this, basically, he says, firstly, that Jesus appeared from the tomb to Mary Magdalene. Then he appears 3 times to the disciples. One of those times is to Thomas. You remember the encounter where Jesus says, Thomas says, "I won't believe unless I see the nail marks in his hands and the wounds in his side." And Jesus shows up, bam, put them there. "Put your hands in these nail marks and in my side." And it changes Thomas's life. "My Lord and my God," he exclaims. Then another time, Jesus appears here. He's appearing by the Sea of Galilee. They're now back at home. And this particular case, this particular appearance is for Peter, because Peter needs some restoring. Now, seven disciples are in Galilee, and Peter says, "I'm going fishing." And they say, "We'll go with you." Well, as they're out fishing about 100 yards from the shore, they hear a voice from the shore that basically says, "Caught anything today, guys?" "No, nothing." "Throw your nets on the other side." They throw their nets on the other side. There's fish everywhere. Absolutely everywhere. And John, the author of this gospel, it dawns on him. "It's the Lord," he says. And Peter, splash. He heads toward the shore. Peter's impulsive. He does things and says things before he thinks about them. He is already 50 yards in. And he comes finally to the shore, sopping wet. And there's Jesus on the shore with a fire, a charcoal fire, not just any kind of fire, a charcoal fire and breakfast waiting there for him and for them. That's where we're going to pick up the story. And what's interesting, and I want to say this at the very beginning, this goes in your first blank on your bulletin, because this is the overall idea of what we're going to see in this passage, is that the first thing that Jesus does in his resurrection state is restore people. That's what he does. That's what Jesus is about. He's about restoring people and restoring things. He's about setting things right. And so the first thing that we're going to see is in Jesus, there is restoration from our past sins, from our past failures, from the sins of others. There is resurrection. There is restoration in Christ. And that brings us into verse 9. When they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place with fish laid on it and bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish that you have just caught." And so Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. That's a lot of fish, especially if they're big ones. And although there were so many fish, the net was not torn. And Jesus said to them, "Come, have some breakfast." Now, none of the disciples dared ask, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. But parenthetically here, he's somehow different. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. Now, this was the third time that Jesus was revealed to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. The most important thing that John wants us to know from this passage is that Jesus, in fact, rose from the dead like he said he would. That's by far the most important thing that needs to be nailed down in us. He is alive. This isn't an apparition. This isn't a group hallucination. This isn't wishful thinking. Jesus is, in fact, alive. But with this, there are three important flashbacks that are going on that are all kind of very relevant to what's going on. The first flashback is from a charcoal fire. This particular fire was in Peter's mind registering deeply. 2 weeks earlier than this, he had followed Jesus to the courtyard of the high priest. He was looking to follow Jesus. He had said he wasn't going to deny Jesus. He was going to stick with him. But he's there in the courtyard at the other end, and Jesus is probably by somewhere about the back wall. Peter is warming himself around a charcoal fire, and he's confronted by some people around that fire. "Aren't you one of his disciples?" "No, I'm not." "No, I'm sure I saw you with him." "No, I'm not." And then finally, the third time, "No, I'm sure that you're one of his disciples." And he says, "I am not." And at that point in time, Luke tells us that Jesus and Peter's eyes met. And so a charcoal fire is a very big deal, because Peter has a charcoal fire etched in his soul. The second flashback comes from the bread and the fish. Now, remember that in chapter 6 of John's Gospel, that Jesus fed 5,000 people with 5 pita pockets and 2 fish. And that proved his ability to provide, and it also, in particular, called his disciples to believe, because he can make something out of nothing. That he can take what little is available and make it into something great. And the third flashback that we have is probably very similar into a very similar spot as this place was 3 years before. And that is, there's a net full of fish following Jesus' instructions. And this is what dawns on John as it's the Lord, because they know this scenario. As you might recall, Jesus was what had got into Peter's boat and asked Peter to push out a little bit from shore so that he could teach and be heard by everyone. What ends up happening is after Jesus finishes teaching, he says, Pete, put out into the deep water. Cast out your nets here. Peter's like, you know, you're an itinerant evangelist guy. You're not a fisherman, but whatever. Okay, I'll put the nets down. He puts the nets down and they're full of fish, just like this. And Jesus says to him after this whole encounter, you're going to be catching people, not just fish. So this is also the place of call, of his call and his purpose. So there are three denials, three appearances, three flashbacks, and all of those say, and this is the second blank in your bulletin, that Jesus will take us back to move us forward. He will take us back to move us forward. He takes Peter back to the place of his failure to restore him into a new future. He takes him back to his failure in the charcoal fire, back to the place of call at that beach, back to the place of faith with the bread and the fish multiplying. And I love the way that Daryl Johnson puts this so succinctly. He says, Peter is unable to enjoy the reality of a bright future and a new present because of a haunting past. Being held back from the fullness of the new life in Jesus because of an unfinished past. Jesus indeed appears on that beach to set Peter free. Now I think, as I've reflected on this a little bit, that we spend all kinds of time and energy running from our past. And you don't have to be particularly old to do this. Although the older that you get, the more past you have, so the more past you can run from. I once heard a guy say it this way, the only problem with running from your past is that you always bring you with you. And so there's no getting away from you if the problem is indeed something that you have done. Or your and my past, that it may have defined us. It may have taken such a big place into our life that the past has completely sculpted who we are. I remember telling you that I flunked second grade and that really all you have to do to graduate into third grade is have a pulse, and I flunked. And it left a mark for a long time. Our past can leave a sizable mark on our lives and begin to kind of steer our lives in one way or another away from this and away from that. The judgments that we have toward this will push us over to this, and the judgments for this will push us over toward this. It's the way that the past works. But Jesus has come here with Peter to address that. Now, interestingly enough, I hear Christians often say, well, Philippians 3:13, it says, you know, we forget what lies behind. But what's interesting about Philippians 3:13 is that Paul has just listed his past with great detail. So he obviously hasn't forgotten his past. What he's saying is that the past no longer controls my present story. That's what's being said. In fact, he's not saying I've just forgotten it like I have amnesia. In fact, he's saying that those things are no longer the controlling narrative of my life. No, something else is going on now. Something else is defining me. And that is Jesus, and I am pursuing him. No, the reality is that we must process who we have been and what we have done with Jesus himself. Or else, who we have been and what we have done will continue to sculpt our future and our present. Do you hear that? And it's a tough one, because I think that a lot of us have spent lots of money on therapy just to do this very thing, but maybe have not ever done it with Jesus. And that's the key. It is not just processing these things with a therapeutic professional, although I think that there's great value in that. No, Jesus wants to be involved. He wants his hands on the wheel. Now, I've said this to you before, but I had a lot of unfinished business with my con man father. And I was challenged at one point in time by a friend, a good friend, who told me that who I was and what I was doing was the outworking of basically my reactions toward and my judgments built on bitterness toward my dad, and I wanted to be something very, very different than that. And he told me that I was going to have to forgive him and then actually help me do it. And that day, it took 3 hours to actually forgive Dad, and it was the first layer. It wasn't all of it, but it was the first layer. And somehow I became a bit more free after I forgave. But it's sort of like an onion that you peel it layer by layer with lots of tears. And in this, I forgave Dad, and then the Lord took me by the hand, and that entire next year, year and a half time, seven different occasions, He said, now we're going to go deeper. We're going to take that forgiveness deeper. We're going to take that forgiveness more holistically. We're going to take it into every area of you, and we're going to have you forgive your dad. Seven times. And I don't think it was because we were trying to be biblically, you know, symbolic. I just think that it was that much. It took that many times just to get me on the path. Because my bitterness and my past was so sculpting me and so governing my story. What about you? What about you? Is the past governing your story? Is it? Is it governing your story? Perhaps a better question is, how much is it governing your story? How much? And I realize that in opening up this can of worms today, that I am starting a process that will not end soon. But I'm actually participating in work already in progress. That this is the Master's best for you. He's the one who says, I don't want you living out your past. I have a new present and a new future for you. And I want you living in it. And I want you living into it. And so you're going to have to face these things. You're going to have to face them with me. Now, this is Peter's process. It isn't necessarily ours, but there's plenty to gain from looking at it. In verse 15, it says that when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, Bar-Jonah, son of John, do you love me more than these? And he said, yes, Lord. You know I love you. And he said to him, feed my sheep. Feed my lambs. And he said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And he said, yes, Lord. You know I love you. And he said, tend or take care of my sheep. And he said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was grieved or hurt because he had said to him a third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Three denials, three questions, three calls to love, three reinstatements or three recommissions. That for Peter, get this, for Peter to take his place as the leader of a new movement, these things had to be addressed inside of him because they were going to go, they were going to propel him forward or keep him back. Now remember what Jesus has said to Peter thus far. In Matthew 16, Peter's the one who said, you know, when Jesus asked, you know, who do the people say I am? Now who do you say I am? He says, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus said to him that this has not been revealed to you by anything earthly. This has been revealed to you by the Father in heaven. And then he gives Peter this open mouth, insert foot Peter. He says, I tell you that you are Peter. And on this rock, it's the word literally there is Petros. That is, what Jesus is saying is, I tell you that you are rocky, yo Adrian. And on this rock, I will build my church and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. And I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. The things that you unlock, I will unlock. The things that you bind up, I will bind up. But Jesus said that to Peter, and he also said that everyone who acknowledges me before men, I will acknowledge before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, Peter knows this, I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven. And Peter simply cannot get around this. He knows that he has disqualified himself, that he has committed the offensive foul of all offensive fouls, that he has not even available to be sent in from the bench. He is disqualified altogether, and he cannot see himself as a sent one like all the rest of the disciples did. He doesn't see himself that way. He can't lead. He can't do what Jesus has called him to do, and that is why Jesus singles him out. I think it's so amazing that we would give up on ourselves. And Jesus, it doesn't. Other people would give up on us, but Jesus doesn't give up on us. I mean, this is a guy, he's sort of a renegade. He's really unpredictable. This is not the kind of guy you want to hand the keys to the car. He's not the sharpest tool in the shed, but he's the one that Jesus is raising up to lead the movement. And he starts by calling him what he knows he really is, or what he thinks he really is. He calls him Simon. He doesn't call him Peter. Because he's summoning him back to this idea that this is your old name. Simon. Simon. This is the old you. And then what's interesting about this whole process is that Jesus addresses Peter's love. Now that's a strange angle at restoring someone. He addresses his love. Do you love me, firstly, more than these? And we don't know what these are. Maybe they're more than these guys. Maybe this group, this friend group, this social media attachment. Or maybe it's this line of work. Or maybe it's your own feelings. But he asks him a searching question. Are you looking backward? Are you looking inward? Are you looking outward? Are you looking upward for your identity? Pete, do you love me? Me. Not the idea of me. Not the idea of religion. Not your obedience. Not your compliance. Not your call. Do you love me? Peter, do you love me? And I believe that part of this process is taking Peter's eyes off of himself and sequentially moving him back onto the one that he loves. Because that's one of the things that failure, that epic fails will do, is it will just get us all huddled into ourselves where we can't get our eyes off of ourselves. Jesus asked him this question, do you love me? I believe that what Jesus is saying here is that your love for me will be the single most important thing in your life. It is the single most important thing in your life, is your love for me. Not your obedience, not anything else. Everything comes from that. And so I have to ask us from this, obviously. Who do you love? Or what do you love? Your life will tell, will give evidence to what you love or who. It will do the telling. It does the talking for us. Who do you love? What do you love? Think for a moment. If I was to catalog all of the things that say what I love, because my love is what directs my life, if I made a little catalog of those different things, what would be jotted down there? And so, why is this important? Because Jesus is restoring us and restoring Peter to love. To his love. To loving him. Then to living a life that is the embodiment of love. I know that this sounds all too basic. But the reality is that, strangely enough, in the New Testament, there are very few times that God is actually defined as something, as a particular quality. And the one time it is it says in 1 John 4, 7 and 8, God is love. And if you and I are becoming more and more like him, we are becoming more and more like love. Right? Does that make sense? We're becoming more and more like love. Not just more loving, although that is part of it. We are becoming love, and we're becoming like Jesus. I love the way that Bob Goff puts it in his beautiful book, Everybody Always. He says, that we have, we've experienced giving away God's love as its own reward. That they or we also don't need to write Jesus as the return address on every loving thing we do. People who are, I love this phrase, turning into love, give their love away freely without any thought of who gets credit for it. Jesus doesn't need credit, and we shouldn't either. That we are turning into love. It's a beautiful phrase. Because it is indeed what God is doing inside of you. As a high school student, as a junior higher, as people that are in the prime of their life, or whatever that you want to call it, or people that are that are in the final chapters of their life, all of it is still about becoming love. It's about becoming love. Turning into love. That is God's end game. That is his beginning game. And that is his everything in between game. That is God's priority. Because he is love. And the quality of your life is defined by the quality of your love. It doesn't look so good when I look in the mirror sometimes. But it is the truth. That for Peter to lead, he must be restored to love, or the movement will quickly degenerate into religion and ritual and rules and all those different things, and not relationship. No, Peter must be reinstated and restored to love. And so Jesus meets him face to face in his shame. And what's interesting is that he asks questions. Because questions tend to draw us out. And Jesus, in this particular case, asked him these questions as a process of helping him get to the heart of things. And the Lord will do that with us all the time. And my guess is that frequently in these message times at church, that God is asking lots of us questions lots of times. He does this with me all the time. But I do this with other people because I sense the Spirit asking me to ask people questions like, how's that working for you? Or this one. Do you think that that guy or that gal will really complete you? Do you really think you can do that without it destroying you? These are questions. And the Lord pushes those questions into our heart. And he's calling us to have some ownership of what's actually going on in our lives and to say, whoa, wait a minute. Actually, a couple of weeks ago, the Lord began to, a series of very focused questions with me. One of them was, where's this thought process coming from? With about that tone, where's this thought process coming from? And then the question, as I interacted in my journal, the question that came from him again in a quiet whisper in my own mind was, do you think that that's really where I'm at with this? I don't know. I mean, frequently the Lord just dumbfounds me with questions because he will ask a question that will kind of weasel its way into the deep parts of me and then kind of explode. I'm like, what do I do? But God has got his hands on me and he's molding me and shaping me. He's got his hands on you and he's molding and shaping you, but he frequently will ask you questions to get you to cooperate, to get you in the process. And that's what he's doing with Peter. Does that make sense? It's really important because in us becoming love, he will actually need to expose what's inside of us, what is keeping us from it. And our past and our hurts and our failures, like Peter's, can damage our love and our love capacity. And most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, when we're hurt, we suffer in the love department more than anywhere else. And so Jesus comes to us and says, I want you to process this with me. I want to lead you through this. I want to lead you through this like I did Peter. Now, what's interesting to me, and I have to say this with this, because Peter is being reinstated and recommissioned and restored, but he's going to take the rest of his life to work out the implications of this. So this isn't a one and done. This is a one that got the process going, but he's going to have to work the implications of this out for the rest of his life. That doesn't mean that it governs his narrative anymore, but it does mean that this is the start. Now, what's interesting is that this restoration doesn't make Peter perfect. It just makes Peter puts Peter back on the playing field and sets things straight with the relationship that he has with Jesus. One last thing. As I look at this passage, and I'm kind of a Greek nerd. The New Testament is written, the primary language of the New Testament is written in is Greek, and it's one of the things we had to learn in grad school and those things. And so I throw myself into the Greek. It's very interesting that in this passage, there are two separate words that are used for love. One is agape, and the other one is phileo. Now, perhaps you've heard this before, but bear with me for just a moment, because I'm sure that all of you haven't. But agape is not just God's love. Agape is a self-giving, other-oriented love. Phileo is brotherly affection. It's the connection and the warmth and the love between two friends. And in this passage, both of those words are used, and it's almost, in my opinion, a little odd, but John actually records it. He just doesn't use love, 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 like we would normally just use, I love ice cream, I love my wife, I love Jesus, and I'm saying completely different things with each one of those. He actually is using different words here, and this is how it goes. It looks like this. Jesus says, Simon, do you agape me? Do you love me with self-giving love? Yes, Lord, I love you like a friend. I phileo. Second time. Simon, do you agape me? Do you love me with self-giving, other-oriented love? Yes, Lord, you know I love you like a friend. Phileo. Then, third time, shifting gears. Simon, do you love me like a beloved friend with affection? And Simon's hurt, and he says, Lord, you know everything. You know that all of my affection is directed toward you. Now, what is up with that? That is bizarre. I don't know if that strikes you as bizarre, but if you look at it in the Greek, it's strange. And as I reflected on this and studied and had to get a lot of other different opinions about this, what I found in this is that, at least I think the most plausible explanation is that the agape kind of love, which is typically described as God's kind of love, it is intended to move us to the place where we are most mature in phileo, brotherly connected affection. What that means is that God doesn't want you just laying down your life for Him. He wants you to be connected to Him. He wants your affections to be warmly directed toward Him. He wants to share life with you, not just share His life with you. He wants your life to be shared with Him and His to be with you. And it is both of those things. It is not just one of those things. And we are being restored both into the affections of Jesus and into the love of Him that is self-giving and other-oriented. We're being restored into both of those things, and this is how we become love, honestly, is that we start growing in this friendship with God. Remember Jesus said earlier on in John's Gospel, I no longer call you servants, because servants don't know what their master is doing. No, I call you, what? I call you friends. You're my friend, if you do what I say. What did he say? He said, the thing that's most important to me, the two commands that are the most important in Matthew 22 are, love the Lord your God, and I'm quoting from the Message paraphrase, love the Lord your God with all your passion and prayer and intelligence. This is the most important, the first on any list, but there is a second that's set alongside it. Love others as well as you love yourself. This is Peter being restored, but this is also God saying, I'm going to take you by the hand here. Perhaps 2019 is a year where we, together, Jesus says, we start to work on the unresolved and unfinished business of your past. So that you can enjoy a new present and a beautiful future. But he's calling you and I into this now. You don't have to be particularly old to appreciate this. Because typically our past will leave a mark. I want to ask you right now, will you let the Lord ask deeply into your soul? A lot of us are pretty protective Like, Lord, you can come this far, but not any further. Will you drop your guard with him? And let him ask deeply into your soul. Let him take your hand. Let him restore you to love. So that you might be a person who's turning into love.